Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from Live Science. A Viking sword over 1,000 years old has been pulled from a river by a magnet fisher in the UK.
A magnet fisher. That's awesome.
I wish
awesome.
We could find stuff like that.
That's true.
I know. I think he's going to be the next king of England, if that's how the myth goes.
Yeah.
Right? Nope.
Watery swords, man. That's how it's done.
I mean, it could not get more ideal of the myth than that, but that is, in fact, what has happened. Experts have confirmed that a sword pulled from a river in Oxfordshire at the end of last year is indeed an archaeologically rare Viking weapon dating between, they're thinking, 850 and 975 AD. It is fairly corroded, as you might imagine, but the finder, his name is Trevor Penny. I am not making that up. He had been down on his luck that day. He'd only been pulling scaffolding poles. But when he lugged out the sword, he wasn't immediately sure what it was. So Penny immediately uploaded images of the sword to Google to try to identify it. Quote, "Whatever photo angle I tried was coming up with Viking sword." The magnet fisher then contacted the Oxfordshire County liaison officer responsible for recording archaeological finds made by the public, who then took the sword to be examined by experts. It has been authenticated, estimated to date 1,200 years ago. This is a time when the Vikings, who were, if you can remember your history, originally pagans from Scandinavia, they would go to the British Isles to, you know, do a little light plundering.
Right, a little murder, a little looting, yeah.
But, you know, occasionally a little trade, you know, everybody gets what they want, we leave alive. But the Vikings set foot on British soil in the 8th century, having raided a monastery. We had raids in Britain occurring for several centuries. They escalated after 835 when larger Viking fleets started arriving and fighting royal armies. British kings were gradually reconquering territory seized by the Vikings throughout the 10th century, but finally unified what was then a patchwork of kingdoms into a new realm that they called Anglaland, which was very difficult for me to get my brain around because it really wants to say England, but it is in fact Anglaland. So this all went on until about the 11th century, but the Viking Age ended following the Battle of Stamford Bridge. This was in 1066, with the defeat of the King of Norway, Harald Sigurdsson, by the Saxons. Mm. So if you want to see this sword, it is in the care of Oxford Museum Services. The officer said it was archaeologically rare to find whole swords. Usually we're just finding fragments, but this was quite the find, and maybe we should all take up magnet fishing. Good God.
Do you get money for that?
It depends on what you find, I guess, but...
Well, to be fair, at least he's not getting in trouble, because there was a little dispute with the landowner and the river's trust.
Oh, it wasn't his.
Yeah, and the latter did send a legal document saying, "We're not going to take action on the condition that you pass the sword to a museum."
Right,
which
right.
He did. So, no treasure, but he didn't get punished.
Hey? Yeah, he gets his name in an article, man. That's what That's they just right. want the recognition.
Yeah, I mean, swords are a couple thousand years old, but the internet, that's forever.
Exactly.
Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from BBC.com. It's titled, "The Drug Pilots Take to Stay Awake."
Oh.
No dose.
Yeah. So, pilot fatigue is in the spotlight this week after the news that one Indonesian flight had two sleeping pilots at its helm.
Mm-hmm.
But military organizations have been grappling with this problem for decades, and they have a surprising solution. Or maybe not so surprising if you live in the 21st century. So, the intriguing tablets were discovered in a Nazi's pocket. The pilot had been shot down over Britain, along with the remains of his methamphetamine supply. At the time, this was the Luftwaffe's favorite pick-me-up for fatigued airmen, known as pilot's salt for its liberal application.
This is right up there with, you know who else used meth? Like...
Yeah, the Nazis.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. But though the Allied forces suspected this, they didn't know for sure. So the pharmacological souvenirs were promptly shipped off for testing, and soon the British were working on their own version. The resulting stimulant was widely distributed and fueled hundreds of late-night missions across Europe. But this was just the beginning. A related drug, dextroamphetamine, again became popular during the Gulf War in 1990-91 when it was taken by the majority of fighter pilots involved in the initial bombardments in Kuwait.
Wow.
Today, this pill is still in use by U.S. military air crews. Oh. They use it to solve the same problem, pilot fatigue, which can creep up on aviators during long missions and compromise their safety. But there's a catch, which is, of course, amphetamines can be highly addictive, yeah. And even in the 1940s, they were widely abused. So, in recent years, military organizations have been on the hunt for another option. Enter modafinil, a stimulant originally developed for the treatment of narcolepsy and excessive daytime drowsiness in the 1970s. The medication has been shown to improve spatial planning, pattern recognition, working memory, and boosting overall cognitive performance, alertness, and vigilance in situations of extreme fatigue. Hmm. But modafinil also has its own flaws.
Mm-hmm.
Side effects can include sweating, pounding headaches, and even hallucinations.
Oh, cool.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And a tendency to feel like you want to murder more.
That's right. Yeah. And start a band, guys. We got to start a band.
So despite these risks, in certain circumstances, it can be a formidable aid to those who need to stay awake. In one early study, the drug kept people alert for up to 64 hours of activity, and its effects have been compared to drinking 20 cups of coffee.
Oh.
Yeah. And modafinil is already widely available, approved for use by air forces in Singapore, India, France, the Netherlands, and the U.S. Meanwhile, an investigation by the Guardian newspaper in the UK revealed that a substantial cache of the drug had been purchased by the UK Ministry of Defense ahead of the beginning of the war in Afghanistan in 2001. But, oddly, intense flights involving serious warfare or maneuvers are not the only ones where pilots tend to struggle with lack of sleep. And in fact, boring flights come with their own challenges. Yara Wingelaar-Jott, a lieutenant colonel and head of the Aerospace Medicine Department in Sosterburg, the Netherlands, says, "If you're just observing, 5 hours feels way longer than when you're doing a combat mission." To find out if modafinil could be the answer, Wingelaar-Jott and colleagues conducted a randomized controlled trial. The volunteers at the Royal Netherlands Air Force were kept up 17 hours and then offered a dose of modafinil, caffeine, or a placebo. Even after an entire night without sleep, some people who took the drug felt that they could probably keep going for another. Of course, there are serious ethical and legal implications involved with offering stimulants like modafinil to military personnel. What would happen if someone refused to take a drug deemed necessary for the success of a mission?
Hmm.
One study on the potential challenges of allowing stimulants in the Canadian Armed Forces highlights the following contradiction, which is, while it's not legal to force someone to take a medication in Canada, it is a legal requirement for personnel to perform any functions that they may be required to perform anytime, day or night. If it was deemed necessary for someone to take modafinil for operational reasons, they could refuse, but they don't have the right to fail as a result.
Hmm.
And like amphetamines, modafinil can be addictive, though much less potent. It is also susceptible to abuse. The medication became a popular smart drug in the 2000s, used by students hoping to stay up all night to study, or time-strapped workers hoping to get ahead. But what does all of this mean for commercial pilots? One 2023 survey of 6,900 pilots working in Europe found that 72.9% felt they did not have sufficient rest to recover between shifts, while three quarters had experienced a microsleep while on duty in the last month.
Microsleep.
Yeah.
Who wants to get on a plane?
Yeah.
that's an insurance term for liability purposes.
Right. They didn't doze off. They experienced a microsleep, and that's normal.
Correct. They're not actually recovering the kind of rest that you can only imagine is going to take twice as long and need to be twice as deep when you go twice as hard, right?
Yeah. Ooh. And I mean, you know, if you've got a 75% chance your pilot having a microsleep and your Boeing 737 MAX having a 50% chance of, it's not 50%, but it's still way too hot, obviously.
Yeah,
it's like almost every day we're seeing something now. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
What's surprising too is that as a pilot, every year you have to go through some pretty rigorous drug tests. Mm. Like if you're on any sort of antidepressant, you can't fly.
Oh,
what?
Wow.
But if you're on meth,
yeah, that's
fly.
Fine.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's extra credit, even.
That's extra credit. Jump right to the front of the line. All right.
Next link.
Next link.
From Live Science, U.S. government wanted to reverse engineer alien ships, but never found any. A highly anticipated review of classified documents from 1945 to 2023 that was submitted to Congress Friday, March 8th, found no evidence that the U.S. government has encountered aliens or covered up their existence. I know this is going to be a hot topic.
I'm just like, of course they said that. Like, that doesn't, I'm not saying there are and it's a big secret. I'm just saying if they had, they wouldn't tell you. So what?
Yeah, new government narrative just dropped.
Yeah, so this is the official narrative. Uh-huh. The report blames UFO sightings in the 1960s on top secret flights of prototype American spy planes and spy craft. While the U.S. government did consider a program to reverse engineer any captured alien ships in the 2010s, apparently, no crafts were ever found, and the proposal was rejected for, quote, lacking merit. Mm. According to Major General Pat Ryder, the Pentagon press secretary, there is, quote, no verifiable evidence for claims that the U.S. government and private companies have had access or have been reverse engineering extraterrestrial technology. He added that most of the sightings were just ordinary objects misidentified.
Or hallucinations because the pilot was on meth. I mean, you know.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting to, yeah. Too, right? Yep. Yeah. The 63-page review was made by the Pentagon's All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, or ARRO, which was established in 2022. To investigate and manage reports of UFO sightings from the U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force. The review included classified and unclassified archival evidence, full access to all secretive government programs related to UFOs, and 30 interviews with intelligence professionals. I'm sorry, I don't think they had full access.
No, I mean, why would you? It's so silly. Like, look, we're showing you everything. We promise.
Right. And all of this came about because of the 2017 leak of the now infamous video clips that showed mysterious wingless aircraft. Conspiracy theories reached their apex when, in July 2023, David Grush, a former U.S. intelligence officer and whistleblower, claimed that the government has been secretly investigating crashed UFOs. In his congressional hearing, Grush told the House Committee on Oversight and Reform that not only had spaceships been recovered, but that, quote, non-human beings had been found inside. Despite bluntly contradicting many of Grush's claims, the report does maintain a brief period when the Pentagon considered a program to reverse engineer alien technology. Called Kona Blue, it was proposed by the Department of Homeland Security by individuals who suspected the U.S. government was hiding crashed UFOs. Quote, this material was only assumed to exist by Kona Blue advocates and its anticipated contract performers.
That's the deal. Boeing's basically like, we don't know if there's aliens, but if there are, we want the contract.
We want that contract. This was only volume one.
Right.
They will publish volume two covering November 23 to April 24. So something could still happen. Apparently, the DOD is working on a portable sensor kit called the, quote, Gremlin system to investigate UFO sightings as they occur. I have no idea how that works or what it is. Kind of a rabbit hole I don't want to go down.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was named very well, though.
Well, the thing is, there's a Gremlin system that we put on F-18s that it's to scramble radio, and we call it the Gremlin system. So I think that was interesting that we also named the thing to hunt UFOs the same thing that we used to scramble.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe it's just coincidence.
Well, we really want dibs, right? So if we're basically scrambling our wake, we'll be first, right?
Yeah. And to your point, none of this proves anything definitively for me.
Yeah.
And yes, I do want to believe, but none of these people will actually have access to some of the secrets that the NSA and Air Force have.
Yeah. I mean, even if it isn't aliens and it is government craft, they're not going to admit that either.
Oh, 100%. Because, yeah, there are people who know the truth. I know one of them, and it's frustrating as hell.
Right. And his name is David Duchovny.
Yeah. He knows. He knows the truth. But that's it on aliens. Nothing to see here, folks. I promise. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, a little bit of a content warning on this next one, especially if you go to the website. It's from NPR affiliate KUOW, and it's called A Cougar Attacked Them. They fought back for 45 harrowing minutes.
Oh, wow. My God.
Yeah.
A cougar, like an older lady?
Yeah. Well, you say that. They, in this case, is five women in their 50s and 60s. So, yes,
oh my God.
This cougar attacked some cougars. Like,
oh, no.
Oh, but they're okay. None of them died. I can laugh at that, right?
Yeah, that's correct. None of them died.
Okay.
So, so, yeah, but these are some feisty ladies. They're in a group of competitive cyclists known as the Recycled Cyclists Racing Team.
And yes!
They are described in the article as warm, optimistic, and badass. So,
goals.
On February 17th, they got together for a mountain biking session at the Tokul Creek Trail near Snoqualmie, Washington. And if you want to see some nice pictures, go to just the top of the article, and you can see a selfie that the five ladies took together just before they headed out that day. Do not, however, scroll down without being ready to see some graphic images, because what happened next was pretty brutal. About 19 miles into the ride, a pair of cougars crossed the trail right in the middle of the line of bikers. Now, cougar sightings in Washington State are relatively rare, but they do happen. And the prevailing advice is to make yourself big and loud. So one of the ladies started shouting, and the first cougar, presumably a mother or a sibling, ran off. But the smaller male cougar paused and then attacked Carrie Berger, age 60, whose bike was just a few paces ahead of where the cougars had come onto the trail. Berger said, "Looking to my right, I saw the cougar's face. It was just a split second, and he tackled me off my bike." And before I go any further, let me just remind you, we've got quotes from this woman because she does make it, okay? All right, hold on to your hats. So, as most big cats do, the cougar went for Berger's head and quickly had her pinned to the ground with her skull in its jaws. She could feel her bones crunching and struggled to breathe face down in the dirt, but she could also hear her teammates immediately leap into action, picking up sticks and trying to beat the animal off of her. One woman stabbed the cougar repeatedly with a 2-inch pocket knife, while another got her arm around its neck and tried to choke it out.
Holy crap!
Wow. Yeah.
Both of these had seemingly no effect, so 59-year-old Anna Teets grabbed the biggest rock she could find, which they later weighed in at 25 pounds, and deadlifted it into a squat and dropped it onto the cougar's head at least 4 or 5 times before it finally let go of her friend about 15 minutes after it had initially attacked.
Oh my God.
Fortunately, Berger was still conscious, and she managed to scramble a little ways away while the rest of the ladies continued fighting, because even after all of this, the cougar wasn't giving up.
What?
Eventually, Tish Williams, age 59, took one of their $6,000 bicycles and used it to pin the cougar down into a small depression in the ground, so sort of like a cage on top. And even then, with three of these ladies standing on the bicycle to keep it down, the cougar nearly threw them off several times. And this whole time, Berger is still just sitting on the side of the trail with her friends occasionally calling out to her, "How you doing?" And Berger just giving them a bloody thumbs up.
Oh my God.
Is your brain coming out of your skull yet?
Yeah, kind of was, yeah. But once they had the cougar under the bike, they were finally stable enough for someone to call 911 on their cell phone, at which point they were told they were in luck because an officer with the Fish and Wildlife Police was nearby, and it would only take him about 30 minutes to get there.
Only 30 minutes.
Yeah. So they just sort of kept him. So at 12:52 p.m., Officer Chris Mositer arrived. He instructed the ladies to definitely remain on top of the bike so he could approach and shoot the cougar between the shoulder blades. The ladies all said later that it was a heartbreaking moment for them because they are all animal lovers. And in fact, Erica Wolf, whose bike was used to pin down the cougar, is actually on the board of PAWS, an animal rescue organization.
Nobody wanted this to happen, but like the cougar chose violence.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, they said, yeah, it was a choice between the cougar's life and Berger's. So no, there was never any question about what needed to be done. An autopsy of the cougar revealed that it did not have rabies, which is good. But the medical examiner also found one of Berger's earrings in the cougar's stomach. Which she took back as a souvenir, not of her trauma, but of her friend's courage. She said, quote, "They're teeny ladies, and I know that the officer shot the final shot, but these ladies killed that cougar with their bare hands."
Yeah.
So Berger is still recovering, but a month after the attack, she is doing much better. And for her photo shoot for the article, she's wearing the same black shirt from that day, which was completely shredded in the attack, but which has now been sewn back together with like thick, brightly colored thread. It makes it look like sort of a floral art piece. Like, it's just yet another sign of what a badass she is.
God, that's the toughest biker gang story I think I've ever heard in my life.
For sure. Because if like the Hell's Angels encountered a cougar, yeah, I think they'd probably win too, but they have guns. Like, these ladies had nothing.
Just hardcore.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So get your grandma's a 2-inch pocket knife, I guess, is if they can't deadlift a rock.
Find thee a bicycling group. Good God.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. We're going to take a cool plunge into the ocean waters with the Guardian, because apparently playing thriving reef sounds on underwater speakers could help save damaged corals.
Like, we trick them? They're like, no, your neighbors are doing fine, so be healthy.
Like, binaural beats for coral?
It's just meditative stuff.
I mean, maybe a little bit of all of the above. I mean, why not? So these were some scientists working off the U.S. Virgin Islands in the Caribbean. They found that coral larvae were up to 7 times more likely to settle at a struggling reef.
Wow.
Where they played recordings of the snaps, groans, grunts, and scratches, which are part of the symphony of a healthy ecosystem. And this matters because the world has lost half its coral reefs since the 1950s. This is due to a number of factors like global heating, overfishing, pollution, habitat loss, outbreaks of disease. So when coral larvae are released into the water column, they're carried onto currents and they swim freely before they find a spot to settle. And once they drop to the ocean floor, they become fixed to the spot. And if they survive, mature into adults. So based on the research and the experiment that was done, the researchers describe how, on average, 1.7 times more coral larvae settled at the salt pond reef than at the other sites where no sounds were being played. Now, these are some promising results, but we do have more work to do to understand whether other coral species respond to reef sounds in the same way, whether the corals thrive after settling, or if they're like, hey, we were tricked. The brochure showed us a happy neighborhood, and now it's all boarded up here. Right?
Yeah, this sounds like those tourism campaigns where they're like, hey, big city fellas, move to Nebraska. You'll love it. And it's like, no, it doesn't last.
But they're just playing New York City sounds in Nebraska so you can feel comfortable.
Putting up Broadway posters everywhere.
I mean, the start of the pandemic, I remember hearing from New Yorkers who said that the level of quiet in the city was deeply unsettling, right? Mm-hmm. Because it became part of the ecosystem. It signals to their nervous system conditioned in that environment that this is safe. Things are working. So
I'm wondering if they tried, like, you know, I know they did sounds, but did they try different music? Like, did they try Chubba Wubba's hit? Maybe that would have helped.
Sorry. Yeah, coral like a lot of stuff, man. You don't know.
It might work. Yeah.
All right, next link.
Next link.
Okay. Important question. Over or under?
Over.
It's the right way.
Well, I have to say under now to split the difference.
Oh, there you go.
Well, it's about toilet paper.
Oh, then over.
Over.
There is a under. Correct answer.
Wrong opinion.
No, it's under is correct.
Oh, no.
How about you tell us?
So, yeah, you know, just one of the most contentious topics in modern civil discourse. This article comes to us from Upworthy.com. It's titled Over or Under. Surprisingly, there actually is a correct way to hang a toilet paper roll.
Yeah, there is.
So we're going to settle this. The over or under question has plagued marriages and casual acquaintances alike for over 100 years, with both sides convinced they have the soundest reasoning for putting their toilet paper loose end out or loose end under. Some people feel so strongly about right versus wrong TP hanging that they'll even flip the roll over when they go to the bathroom in the homes of strangers.
That's passive
a little
aggressive.
Bit far. Yeah.
I'm sure they're fun to hang out with.
Yeah. But contrary to popular belief, it's not merely an inconsequential preference. There is actually a correct way to hang toilet paper, according to health experts, as well as the man who invented the toilet paper roll in the first place.
Oh, okay. They went to the source.
Yeah. So which one is the right way? According to health experts, over is the way to go. Dr. Christian Morrow, Associate Professor of Health Sciences and Medicine at Bond University on Australia's Gold Coast, said one key to maintaining a hygienic washroom is minimizing contact between people and surfaces. Depending on the type of roll holder, hanging the toilet paper over often lowers the chance that a user will touch the wall behind when fishing for paper, leaving germs behind on that surface, which can spread to the next user. Touching any surface in a bathroom is pretty nasty, according to a study from the University of Colorado. Inc.com reported, using a high-tech genetic sequencing tool, researchers identified 19 groups of bacteria on the doors, floors, faucet handles, soap dispensers, and toilets of 12 public restrooms in Colorado, 6 men's rooms, and 6 women's restrooms.
Ooh, that's some thankless research, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I just go outside.
Yeah.
Just bypass the problem entirely.
Let's go.
Many of the bacteria strains identified could be transmitted by touching contaminated surfaces. Bacteria, of course, means things like E. coli, which is a common source of food poisoning and one of the most common bacteria found on bathroom surfaces in the study. If you've ever had a bout of food poisoning, you probably agree that a toilet paper roll hanging preference isn't worth risking it. Now, that is the editorialization of the author of this article, not me. Maybe you want to risk it. I don't know. I don't judge people for their choices. I'm just saying one is right and one is wrong.
Exactly.
I, however, will judge for choices, including the toilet seat stays down because the toilet bowl is full of disgustingness. And so you keep it closed.
You're talking about the lid.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. No, we habitually keep the lid down because I saw that Mythbusters episode where they talked about if you flush with the lid up, you are spraying microparticles all around the room. And if you put the lid down and then flush, it stays contained a lot more. So that's,
correct.
I'm on board with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for the record, my spouse, one of the reasons they knew that I was the one, and they told me this, is because the first time they came over to my house, they went into the bathroom and the lid was down. So take note. It also matters for your romantic life, I guess, potentially.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but sanitary health concerns aren't the only argument for the overcamp. After all, the original patent for the toilet paper roll issued in 1891 clearly shows the TP in the over position.
Hey!
Now, before the under folks come running with their pitchforks, there are some understandable exceptions to the over rule, namely cats and kids. So if you have a furry friend or a tiny toddler who likes to unroll the toilet paper roll, over makes it super fun for them, while under stops them in their tracks. Yeah. For many people, cats and kids are the primary motivator of their TP hanging habits.
Super fair.
This doesn't change the fact that over is actually the quote-unquote correct way to hang toilet paper according to health science and the inventor's intention, not that that matters, but under is certainly preferable to having a pile of TP on the floor. So, Bradley, I'm sorry. I hope you don't feel attacked. It's not my intention.
No. Yeah, no, the only reason I said over was because of the cat. That's the only reason why we switched from over for a brief period was because I walked in there and it was on the floor.
Yeah, we've actually gone even more extreme than that. I have a dog who likes to eat toilet paper and will not stop. And so we've had to basically take all of the toilet paper rolls off of the rolls entirely. And they're like up on shelves or something behind or near the toilet where the dog cannot get to them. And in one bathroom where there is nowhere to put it, we had to install this special, like, fully encased aluminum cylinder.
Like the ones at the public restroom?
Well, no, because those you can still go from underneath. This is literally like a casket, and you have to open up the lid, pull the toilet paper out, and then make sure you, like, tuck the end back in before you close it, or she will get it. Like, it's a problem.
You have a TP dish.
I do. I have an absolute, like, contained keg of toilet paper.
Neither over nor under, but a secret third, more complicated thing.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of, like, bubble tape. You know, the bubble gum that comes in that roll where it's just constant chomping and nomming, but it's a dog and toilet paper, which I know has, it's tragic and you're trying to prevent it, but I've never heard of such a thing.
Oh, listen, when we started Googling it, the products exist, so clearly it's not just my dog.
Wow.
Oh, gosh.
Well, now you all know, do what you want. America is a free country.
That's right.
If you live in another country where toilet roll orientation is mandated, I'm sorry.
Mandated.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from Science Alert. Every 2.4 million years, Mars does something unexpected to our ocean depths. Geoscientist Adriana Dutkiewicz of the University of Sydney was surprised to find these 2.4 million year cycles in the deep sea sedimentary data. She says, quote, there's only one way to explain them. They are linked to cycles in the interactions of Mars and Earth orbiting the sun. To me, that seems a bit sure-footed. Only one way?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not a geoscientist, so I can't say. In recent years, scientists have started to identify what they have termed an astronomical grand cycle. This is a 2.4 million year pattern linked to the alignment between the orbits of Earth and Mars. We know that other planets can influence Earth's path around the sun, tugging it into a more elongated shape or regular cycles known as Milankovitch cycles that coincide with the rise and fall of ice ages. These are much more frequent, occurring over tens of thousands of years, created primarily by interactions with Jupiter and Saturn, far heftier planets than the relatively small Mars. However, with the grand cycle of 2.4 million years, direct evidence of its interaction in Earth's geological record is scarce. So the Milankovitch cycles were confirmed in 1976 when scientists found they had been recorded in ocean floor sediments. Dudkiewicz and her team were looking for something different. They were trying to determine if the currents at the bottom of the ocean change when the climate is warmer, whether they became more vigorous or slow down. They based their analysis on 293 scientific deep sea drill holes around the world in which they found evidence of 387 breaks in the sediment over the past 70 million years. While plotting these breaks over time, they noticed a curious cluster, the 2.4 million year cycle that matched the astronomical grand cycles of Earth and Mars. In addition, these breaks lined up with known periods of warmer climate, including the famous Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. It's famous. I don't have to tell what you got.
Oh, obviously. Famous, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah. It took place some 56 million years ago when Earth's temperature rose by up to 8 degrees Celsius or 14.4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
This event has been attributed to a number of different causes, including a glitch in the Earth's orbit and a passing comet. So a potential link with Mars could be a contributing factor.
Or the dinosaurs fully evolved, made cell phones, caused their own climate change, all died out, and we just missed it. We haven't found any evidence of that yet.
The Solarians, yes.
Yes, I know.
We got a magnet fish for the evidence, guys.
So why is this surprising? It actually goes against current models, which suggest that the circulation system responsible for the Gulf Stream could shut down as global warming melts sea ice. So scientists had thought that a global warming climate would result in a deep sea that is much less active. But here's the good news. Major storms become much more frequent in warmer climates, producing sediment that stirs eddies that can extend as far as the deepest abysmal depths of the ocean. This could mean that the oceans are a little bit more resilient to climate change than we thought they are. Okay, let me be clear. This doesn't mean to climate change deniers, the sea, it's not our fault. It's not a this or that,
right.
It's a this and that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely still comes at the cost of horrible thunderstorms at the surface, though. Like, the ocean might be
absolutely.
Fine, but we won't.
We won't. And yeah. And actually, they say that in the article. It's like, let's be clear, we won't be okay, but the ocean floor will probably be okay.
Yeah, well, good. We'll have some good trilobites down there. They'll rise up again in another couple million years.
Let the kaiju have their time.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Last Gold Beater in Venice, Are White Holes Dawning at Last, and High-Tech Makeover Converts Drinking Bird Toy into a Practical Generator. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.